Now, one of Walmart's big online competitors, Amazon, is running into a little trouble with its popular e-reading device. The Kindle has the ability to read text out loud, so it should, in theory, appeal to the visually impaired. It's not working out that way, as reporter Chris Bolt of member station WAER reports.
Syracuse University's library decided not to purchase any more Kindles after complaints by disability groups. Library spokesperson Pamela McLaughlin explains the text-to-speech function is just about impossible for a blind person to use.
If people don't start to push back and say, we won't buy it if it isn't accessible, that's when there's incentive for those vendors to actually change their business practices.
Amazon publicizes the audio feature as a convenience.
With Kindle's text-to-speech function, you can switch from reading to listening on the fly.
The girl squinted toward the window, and it seemed for a minute.
The problem is you need to see on-screen controls to use it. Amazon did not return phone calls for the story, but spokesperson Drew Herdner told the Associated Press the company is working on it. Eve Hill with the Burton Blatt Institute for Disability Studies is not convinced.
That's simply not an adequate answer. It's not that hard a fix, and a sort of vague promise just doesn't remedy ongoing discrimination.
Leaders of the boycott are urging universities and libraries not to purchase any electronic readers until they're fully accessible. For NPR News, I'm Chris Bolt in Syracuse.
It was DARPA, or rather ARPA, as it was known in 1969, that funded the first computer network. The system was called the ARPANET, and it was to the Internet what the Neanderthal is to modern man. As part of our series, The Net at 40, we're exploring the ideas behind it and talking with the people who helped build it. And before we meet our next guest, let me ask you this question. When was the last time you actually put pen to paper and mailed off a personal letter to someone? I can't remember the last time I did, and of course the reason is email. Now, back in 1971, Ray Tomlinson was working on a system that would allow him to send messages from one computer to another. And he needed a way to separate the name of the sender from the name of the computer so the addresses wouldn't get confused. He decided to use the at symbol. Tomlinson's messaging system eventually became the email that we use today. And Ray Tomlinson is in Boston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Could you ever have imagined that the system you were working on in 1971 would change the way we all communicate today?
I guess I could have imagined it. What I didn't imagine was how quickly that would happen. What it took was a very marked growth in networks and computers to make it all happen.
And what were you trying to do in 1971?
Well, in 1971, I was busily trying to find things to use this newfangled network for. I heard about a proposal to send messages to be printed with a printer and stuffed away in mailboxes for people to read. And I said, these messages should go to computers.
Hmm.
And so I thought about it for a bit and then decided to put together a system that might do that.
And so you were just kind of doing this on your own. Nobody said, hey, Ray, can you invent email?
And the statement of work did not say, thou shalt go forth and invent email. But we were working on ways in which humans and computers could interact and try to improve that interaction.
Do you remember what your first email said?
Well, everybody asked that. And, of course, I don't remember every single word of it. The main thing is there were lots of test messages. You know, these things don't work out of the box because there was no box. Every time you test, you have to generate some kind of a message. And you might drag your fingers across the keyboard or just type the opening phrase from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or something else. So technically, the first email is completely forgettable and therefore forgotten.
Who did your first message go to?
All the test messages were sent to myself.
Hmm.
I had two computers that were literally side by side. The keyboards were about 10 feet apart. And I could wheel my chair from one to the other and type a message in one and then go to the other and see what I had tried to send.
Now, why did you pick the at sign, this iconic symbol? How did you pick that symbol?
Yeah, well, it certainly wasn't an icon back in 1971. But it was a key on the keyboard that did not appear in users' names, not appear in host names. It made sense. It's a preposition. It means user at host. It is the only preposition on the keyboard.
So did you become a internet billionaire from this?
No, I didn't.
You're not a billionaire today.
Not by several more orders of magnitude.
Hundreds of millions?
No, I've often thought about what it would have taken, what fraction of a cent per at sign would it take to make me very comfortable. And it's a very small fraction.
So, Ray Tomlinson, do you feel comfortable with the title Ray Tomlinson, Inventor of Email?
Oh, yeah, you can call me that.
Fair enough. That's Ray Tomlinson, the inventor of email and a principal engineer at Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, now known as BBN Technologies. You can find out more about the invention of email at our website. That's npr.org. Ray Tomlinson, thanks very much.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad I had this opportunity to speak to you and your audience.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you got for us today?
We have kind of a creepy one. It seems sort of related. Instead of multiple personalities, you have one personality and multiple faces.
Ooh.
Due to the scary wind.
I'll do the wind. Go ahead.
All right. So imagine this. So you have all these personalized ticks right on your face. You move your mouth a certain way. You move your eyes a certain way. Now imagine those on someone else's face. Mm. Researchers have figured out how to clone your facial expressions and then transplant them digitally onto someone else's digital face. And it's sort of like a digital video puppet.
Wow.
Being driven by a real person.
Wow. So as the real person is speaking, the puppet is speaking?
Yes.
Along with that person.
Absolutely. So it looks like you are talking, but there's someone else who is sort of making those gestures with your words coming out of their mouth.
Wow. And it's all digitally done.
It's all digitally done. So you might be thinking, you know, why?
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 Why do this? Why go to all this trouble?
Well, Barry John Theobald, who's one of the guys who developed this technique, is interested in taking text and then creating a digital person who will say it. So that's sort of his main goal.
So you'd be able to type text in and that,
and then create a digital avatar who would be speaking it.
So you get more lifelike.
Right. And this is like step one on that process.
Yeah.
But psychologists are interested in this too, is a way to study human behavior. So the idea is that you can put real people in conversations with these kind of digital avatars, and then you can change things like the person's gender. So you can have a man driving a woman's face.
Well, so you could study the gender differences then.
Right. And the idea is, you know, how do we respond to a woman who has sort of a man's facial expressions?
And on our website at sciencefriday.com, I'm amazed at how good the renditions are, right?
Yeah,
these
faces. This is kind of an amazing thing. The psychologist, Stephen Booker, said that he's run this experiment on 130 people. And of those 130, only 3 people noticed there was something a little off about these avatars.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
So it's worth going to look and see if you can decode the avatar from the real person.
Can you tell which one is the real? And of course, who knows where this kind of research, the video part of it, might wind up in the movies or films or where they want to really recreate.
Yeah, I think that is related to this. This is a 2D version, but the 3D versions are even more sophisticated.
All right. Well, you can see Flora's video pick of the week at our website at sciencefriday.com up there in the left corner. Also, we have a whole archive of our other video picks of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
That's about all the time we have for our program, which is produced by Christopher Intagliata, senior producer at Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our SciArts producer, and Shelley Du Bois, our Spanish language producer. Neil Rauch is our technical director, and at the controls here, Manya, right here in New York today. We also had a help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can see the video pick of the week, and also we're podcasting and blogging and tweeting and doing that all week and creating a science community for you to stay in touch with us. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. If you're driving at the moment and you're using a GPS system for navigation, you can thank a small and somewhat secretive branch of the Pentagon. It's called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA for short. Now, aside from the GPS system, DARPA has, over the past 50 years, brought us things like the internet, robotic arms, self-driving cars, and prototypes of supersonic spaceships. Now, for most of those years, DARPA's been off-limits to reporters, but Michael Belfiore managed to get in and write about the agency. His new book is called The Department of Mad Scientists, and Michael Belfiore joins me from New York. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
How did DARPA come about?
DARPA came about for the same reason that NASA did. In 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik, caused a great amount of consternation at the Defense Department as well as many other places in the United States, and was felt very strongly we have to do something. The Eisenhower administration ultimately had in mind a big, sprawling, well, what became a big bureaucracy, NASA, but they wanted to do something that would get into effect much faster. So they came out with ARPA, it was called at the time. Didn't have D for defense, but it's the same agency. The idea was to get a bunch of people in a room and get them cooking up ideas for defeating the Soviets in space. NASA came along and later in 58 took over the space mission. And so they moved into other areas such as information technology.
And eventually, as I mentioned earlier, scientists and researchers there went on to create what we now know as the internet and things like GPS.
That's right. They don't have any of their own laboratories. They just have people coming up with the ideas. These are PhDs, research scientists, as you mentioned, who just come up with the ideas. Then they go out into the field and they find people at universities, at private companies, who can actually put those ideas together.
I want to ask you about some of the gadgets and things you came across working on this book. Things like self-driving cars, do they work?
Self-driving cars do work. And this is actually, I think, a great success story for DARPA. The idea is they want to develop cars that can drive themselves through war zones so we don't have human drivers at risk. But this is part of what makes DARPA very interesting to me. They don't just own the technology after they create it. The institutions that they hire to do the work of creating things then have the right to go and develop these things on their own for the most part and to market them to the public. So DARPA sponsored three auto races that were driven by self-driving cars. And the latest one was in 2007. I watched these cars drive through city streets, stop at stop signs, signal their turns, stay within the speed limit. It's a very strange auto race. And these are starting to roll out these technologies in commercial vehicles, production vehicles. So you don't have to go all the way to fully autonomous to get benefits. You can have a car that can sense an impending collision and warn a driver of it. Or perhaps even actually automatically swerve your vehicle away from a potential accident.
So the technology is there already.
It's absolutely there, yeah.
We've talked about things that are great and indispensable, but is there a dark side, in a sense, to some of the projects that have come out of DARPA or DARPA research?
Some of the work that DARPA is doing, I'm sure, is quite nasty. I was only allowed to see about half of what they do. Mm. So about 50%, I'm told, of what DARPA is doing is off limits to any outsider.
I mean, but we can assume that there are certain projects and weapons that they might be working on that could be incredibly effective and also destructive.
I've got just a glimpse of some of that. They're working on bullets that can guide themselves. So sort of missile technology compressed into the size of a bullet. So you just sort of fire your weapon in the general direction of where you want it to go and it guides itself. They're also working on robotizing insects. So if you can implant very small electronics and control systems into insects, then you can use them as mini UAVs, mini unmanned vehicles.
The title of your book is The Department of Mad Scientists. So talk a little bit about the culture inside of DARPA.
I called the book The Department of Mad Scientists because they have a philosophy that unless something is so out there that a lot of people think it's impossible, it's probably not worth working on as a project. And when Tony Tether came in to DARPA, this was the director of DARPA who was there when I was writing the book. He's no longer there. But when he came in, his mission, as he saw it, was to keep this culture where people ran around, as he said, with their hair on fire, meaning that they were thinking so hard about so many extraordinary things that their hair, their brain overheated and their hair caught on fire. And there is a bit of that feeling there. Of course, literally, they're not running around, you know, cackling and you know, working with bubbling beakers of noxious smelling fumes. The idea is, though, that they are kind of hanging it out there. And this is a time, I think, that we're living in that's analogous to that time in the late 50s when we perceived this threat from the Soviets, this new threat from outer space. We're facing global warming. We're facing energy reserves that are controlled by hostile countries. And I think you need to really push the envelope to solve those things. And I think that DARPA exemplifies the kind of, you know, let's go for broke attitude that you don't see in a lot of places, and I think that we're going to need to see.
That's Michael Belfiore. He's the author of The Department of Mad Scientists, speaking with me from New York. Michael Belfiore, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Every morning, people of all ages across the United States wake up, plow the fields, plant new crops, and buy livestock. They're not necessarily farmers, but Facebook users playing a hugely popular online game called Farmville. Dean Takahashi writes about gaming, among other things, for the technology news blog VentureBeat. He joins us from Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Mr. Takahashi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So how do you play this game exactly?
You just start clicking on your Facebook page. There's a little window that opens up when you start the game, and then you plant, you grow, and you sell stuff, and maybe you buy things as well. And that's it. It's just a very simple game with two-dimensional graphics, you know, funny farm music, and a cornucopia of choices of things you can do.
Any idea how many people are playing this game?
63.8 million monthly active users. It's the most popular thing you can do on Facebook now.
Mr. Takahashi, any idea why Farmville's so popular?
You know, as a hardcore gamer, I really don't get it. This is a game for the rest of the people out there who don't consider themselves to be gamers. There are lots of women playing it, lots of teenagers, people who are wanting to socialize with their friends, and this is the way they do it.
Something just occurs to me. This is dime store psychology, but the number of people who are actually farming in this country is in decline and has been for some time. I wonder if farming has now become as fanciful as Space Invader games for millions of Americans.
Yeah, it's a fantasy. It's something they wish they could do, but they can no longer do in a big crowded city. People just want to get back to something simpler. It almost reminds me of the organic movement. You know, they're very interested in where their foods come from these days. And in the same way, here, you get to grow your own foods.
Except, of course, you're not. It's just a game.
Right. It's all virtual. But it is real money, though. There's definitely a lot of money being made in these games.
Yeah. How does that happen?
They don't charge for the game. They give it to you for free. And that's how they hook you. And then you find there's things that are frustrating for you, like it may take a whole day for you to accomplish something that you don't want to wait for. And so you can buy something like a tractor, for example, to plow your fields faster. And you pay for these with real money.
Who are you paying when you buy a virtual tractor?
You're paying the company that had to make the game and the companies like Facebook that have to host the game.
So, Mr. Takahashi, how are your crops doing this fall?
I have not paid enough attention to them, so some of them are withering right now.
Dean Takahashi writes about gaming and technology for the blog VentureBeat. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Tens of thousands of people lined up this weekend to see the world come to an end in the new movie 2012. The disaster movie was number one at the box office. Now, according to numerous sources, mainly on the internet, in the actual year 2012, a planet called Nibiru will crash into the Earth, resulting in the extinction of the human race. Or the Earth's magnetic poles will flip, causing the planet's rotation to reverse direction, resulting in the extinction of the human race. Or the Earth will enter a dark rift in the Milky Way galaxy, resulting in the extinction of the human race. David Morrison is an astrobiologist at NASA, and he's been answering hundreds of questions from people who are concerned about what may happen in the year 2012. He joins us from his office in California. Welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
What is NASA doing to prevent the planet Nibiru from crashing into Earth and creating a disaster?
NASA has nothing to do with the planet Nibiru because it doesn't exist. What NASA is doing, or perhaps I should say what I am doing, is try to answer all these people who are really scared and see if we can't get some facts out to counteract the mythology on the Internet.
What about magnetic poles flipping?
The Earth reverses its magnetic polarity once every 400,000, 500,000 years. There's no reason to think it will happen now. No reason to think that it would cause a problem if it did. And more to the point, it's just fake to say that if the magnetic polarity changed, that would have anything to do with the rotation. They're uncoupled.
Well, what about the dark rift?
The dark rift is just a place where there are dust clouds in the Milky Way. I can't imagine where anybody decided to be afraid of that. I've had so many astronomical things that people are afraid of. They're afraid of the star Betelgeuse. They're afraid of the galactic center. They're afraid of black holes. And it's just all vapor.
So there is no cover-up. NASA is not covering this up.
NASA is not covering it up.
Okay, now hundreds of people have been writing to you asking you about 2012. And they are genuinely concerned and frightened about this.
Most people who write to me are simply asking, will the world end? But the ones that really bother me, I don't know how to answer.
But which ones bother you?
I've had three from young people saying they were contemplating committing suicide. I've had two from women contemplating killing their children and themselves. I had one last week from a person who said, I'm so scared. My only friend is my little dog. When should I put it to sleep so it won't suffer? And I don't know how to answer those questions.
This is really serious. I mean, this is not just a joke. I mean, there are actually people who really believe this.
Yes, and it seems strange to many of us because we know that there's a lot of fakery on the Internet. But apparently there are people who do believe it.
Now, you're a serious astrobiologist. I mean, you have devoted your life to a very serious profession. Is it sort of, you know, annoying for you to have to answer these questions from people out there in the Internet blogosphere world and so on?
It's unexpected. My questions on the Internet are about astrobiology. And I still get a few astrobiology questions about life in the universe, but they're overwhelmed by this concern about 2012. And it does upset me, not because it takes away from my time, but because all these people are being fooled by a big hoax.
Now, 3 years from now, when December 21st, 2012 comes and goes, let's say without an incident, do you think that will be the end of all this doomsday stuff?
There's a long history of doomsdays. Remember Y2K?
Yeah, of course.
Even the planet Nibiru was predicted to come and hit the Earth in May of 2003. As far as I know, it didn't, and someone just pushed reset, and now it's coming in 2012. So I don't think we'll ever be rid of apocalyptic stories about Planet X and the end of the world.
That's David Morrison. He's an astrobiologist with NASA, and he joined me from the Ames Research Center in San Jose, California. Dr. Morrison, thank you so much.
And enjoy 2013 when it comes.